Notes, I'm Farai Chidea. There is no rest for the weary. Yesterday, 24 states held Democratic or Republican political contests. So what happened? Well, let's start with what didn't happen. None of the candidates won convincingly in either of the races. Here's Republican Mitt Romney.
One thing that's clear is this campaign's going on.
Yeah! And here to break it down for us is NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. Hey, Ron.
Hello, Farai.
So, I can hear a little weariness in your voice. Were you up late last night? Anyway.
It all sort of runs together.
Exactly. So, are we any closer to having a Republican or Democratic nominee after yesterday?
Republican, yes. Democratic, no. I'm afraid that there's quite a contrast between the parties. The Republicans engineered their rules to try to reach consensus and get it done, and those rules went to work last night. John McCain, with an impressive performance, winning New York, California, Illinois, New Jersey, all but Massachusetts, really. And Massachusetts, after all, is Mitt Romney's home state. And he also won in Utah, the most Mormon state, and several small caucus states. Mitt Romney really did not make much of a showing at all on Super Tuesday. He was eclipsed by Mike Huckabee, who won five states, all in the South, but he won five states, including the large Georgia and somewhat smaller Tennessee. Pretty impressive to become at least a regional champion. So he really had more bragging rights yesterday than Mitt Romney, who has to be today really taking a long look at how much of his own money he wants to spend on running this out.
Well, you mentioned Mike Huckabee. He was counted out by some people before yesterday. And let's hear a little bit from him.
Over the past few days, a lot of people have been trying to say that this is a two-man race. Well, it is. And we're in it.
So where does that campaign go from here?
I think the Huckabee campaign can go into a number of states that have either a southern flavor or that are in the South or that have a substantial number of evangelical voters, or it can go on and become the general receptacle for all people who don't want to accept John McCain as the nominee. Now, McCain is about halfway to the delegate total that he needs to be the nominee, and he should be able to run up the rest in the remaining events as we go through February and March, maybe even into April. It shouldn't be a problem for him, and there does not seem to be a path for the Mitt Romney candidacy. So if Romney decides to save a little bit of his personal fortune for his many heirs, then Mike Huckabee could slide into the slot as the alternative Republican, remain in the race, do decently well. He's not probably going to take very many states away from John McCain, but do well enough to essentially establish a claim to that number two slot on the ticket.
You've mentioned Romney's finances. He's a wealthy man. He's been dipping into his own millions of dollars. By what amount? How much has he spent so far, you think?
Well, $35 million of it is on the books. That's all been reported. I think everyone will agree that if he's spent that much by the end of last year, he probably spent well over $50 million when you count in all the January and all the Super Tuesday competitions. Some people think it could be substantially more than that, but certainly $50 million, maybe closer to $60, $65,
$70. Kind of hard to take the consolation prize when you put up that kind of money.
It's true, but there's a fairly active dislike between Romney and the other two main Republican candidates. Huckabee and McCain have actually been collaborating a fair amount. Huckabee won West Virginia yesterday with support from McCain people. And it's entirely possible that Mitt Romney would just see what's going on here and decide he's not going to be the vice president. There's nothing really further for him to gain.
Well, let's talk about the Democrats. How did those two candidates do?
We'll be talking about these two Democrats for quite some while, because while Hillary Clinton won the dominant events, the marquee events of California, New York, New Jersey, also Massachusetts, despite those very high-profile endorsements for Barack, Barack Obama did quite well across the country in many different regions, in smaller states, in red states, in blue states, one in every region something, and of course had some very impressive wins in Illinois and Georgia and Missouri, apparently, although that one still some question of might. There might be a recount in Missouri. It was exceedingly close, right around 1 percentage point of the vote. So if he does rack up Missouri, it's going to be pretty much a wash in delegates. He got almost as many delegates yesterday as Clinton did. Astonishing, but true.
Now, when you look at the numbers, do you see any trends in terms of demographics, who voted for whom?
Yes, we see the trend towards more and more African Americans voting for Barack Obama intensifying, going up from 75% or 80% to 90% in Illinois and some other states. Tremendous performance in that community. We also see the Latino community still loyal to Hillary Clinton, which was her margin of victory in California, and a big boost for her in several other states as well. Although Barack Obama is beginning to get a little more of the Latino vote, up from, say, 20-25% into the 30s. That's a trend that he needs to obviously expand on if he's going to be competitive in Texas, which is coming up on March 4th, and is probably Hillary Clinton's best state in the remaining calendar.
So what's ahead for those two candidates?
Most immediately, they've got Louisiana and Washington State and Nebraska coming up on Saturday. And then next Tuesday, the Chesapeake primary, as we call it, Virginia, Maryland, and the District of Columbia, three states that Barack Obama will be favored to win, I believe, across the board. So he needs to do that and not lose what momentum he gained by surviving so well on Super Tuesday.
Now, will this contest go all the way to the convention in August? Is that even a possibility?
It is a possibility because the Democratic rules are not written, as the Republican rules are, to help someone amass the necessary delegates to be the nominee once they've established some primacy among the candidates. And in fact, because these two candidates are so evenly matched at this point, they could go on splitting the delegates almost down the middle, right straight through the primaries I've mentioned, also Ohio on March 4th, Pennsylvania on April 22nd. And the superdelegates, of course, can go back and forth and make up their minds as many times as they like. They're free agents and they're 20% of the total. So it's conceivable that we will not have a consensus behind a Democratic nominee and we'll have to battle it out at the convention in late August.
All right. Well, Ron, thanks again.
Thank you, Fry.
Ron Elving is NPR's senior Washington editor. He joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. And now we got a couple more folks who are no strangers to the strange game of politics. Ron Christie is vice president of the lobbying group D.C. Navigators. He's also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. And Mary Frances Berry is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Hi, folks.
Hello.
Hello, Fry.
So, big night. Senator Hillary Clinton got big states, New York and California. Senator Barack Obama walked away with more states. So, Mary, for you, what was the biggest moment of last night?
Well, it was when Hillary Clinton won Massachusetts, because I was sitting there expecting Obama to win Massachusetts. He had Deval Patrick, who's the governor, the Kennedy machine or the Kennedy mystique. And I thought he's endorsed by the two senators. He's got Deval. Boy, this guy's going to win. I was just, you know, expecting him to win. And then I had looked at some pollsters who said, oh, yes, and I'd been listening to pundits. And then when he didn't and she won, I thought, my goodness, how did that happen? And then I guess the next one after that was when she won Arizona. I was surprised by the places she won. I expected Obama to win Georgia. It would have been a shock if he hadn't won Georgia. So that was first. And I expected him to win the red states where he went out and campaigned, and there are a few voters, and there are some Democrats, and there was the hype. And then my next shock came when she won California, because I had been reading about the rock star campaign and Ofra and all the things that were out there and looking at them and thinking, my gosh, how can anybody who first doesn't have the money, because Hillary, as we know, didn't raise as much money this time, doesn't have the media, because most of the media is waiting and panting for the Obama story to come to fruition. It's one of the greatest stories of their lives. And then here she doesn't have the Kennedys, and she doesn't have Ofra. And then when I looked up on the screen and she had won, I said, my goodness, I don't know how that happened. So
let me get Ron in here. It sounds to me a little bit, Mary, like you're making Hillary sound like an underdog who triumphed. Now, Ron, we're going to move on later to the Republicans, but what did you see? What was in the tea leaves for you from the Democratic side?
Well, I hate when my friend steals my thunder. I was going to say
Sorry. The same thing.
But Mary nailed it. I think that one of the biggest surprises last night was Massachusetts, with all of the heavy hitters in that state coming out for Senator Obama, and particularly the ties back to Camelot, and she won. But what I also found interesting about the Democrats, and particularly Senator Obama, is he did well in traditional red so-called Republican states. I mean, he did win in Georgia. He got the bellwether state of Missouri. I found it very interesting that not only did he win more states last night than Senator Clinton did, but he seems to have a very broad appeal, not just in the northern New England states or New York and whatnot, but he really seems to have an appeal across the country, which I think translates very well for him should he prevail and become the Democratic nominee.
I want to give you one caveat about the winnings in the red state. I was looking at the red states and seeing which ones of those let independents vote. And I was looking, some of them don't, and I was looking at them and seeing how many of the are red because the Republicans win them all the time. So what it said to me was if you have Democratic voters in a caucus especially, he can win, but that doesn't mean he's going to win the state because that's a whole entirely different thing. And so to predict that on that basis, but it was a very exciting night. I think the other thing that I kept looking at is that it is clear that Hillary Clinton won the most delegates last night. The media and the pundits kept saying, well, it's tied or it's close or it's whatever. Even in Missouri, however it comes out, they will get the same number of delegates, exactly the same number because of that screwy system the Democrats have. So I just thought it was amazing. And I don't mean underdog in any sense. I just think I've always thought that in campaigning, if you have the money, and that hasn't turned out this way because McCain didn't have any money and neither does Huckabee. But I always thought if you had the money and you had the media and you had the big mole, as George Bush used to say, and you had, and now I was thinking if you have Oprah, and then so I was just shocked that her obituary wasn't written, to tell you the truth.
All right, guys. Well, we're going to have to take a quick break, but we're definitely going to come back with you. We're talking to Ron and Mary. Ron Christie, Vice President of the lobbying group DC Navigators, and Mary Frances Berry, Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. If you're just joining us, we've been talking politics with Ron Christie, the vice president of the lobbying group DC Navigators, and Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. So I'm going to jump right into the Republican side. So, Ron, West Virginia was a win for Huckabee, but Romney's campaign claims that McCain voters were throwing their weight behind Huckabee, conspiring to squeeze Romney out of the race, if you can follow all that. So McCain denies talking with Huckabee and making a deal. What happened?
Well, I think the one dynamic on the Republican side that has thrown this context into a little bit of flux is the presence of Governor Huckabee. The conservatives right now are looking for the candidate to coalesce behind. Governor Huckabee did very well last night in his home state. He racked up several victories that were rather unexpected, I think, for many of us on the conservative side, and it's splitting the vote that would have otherwise gone to a Fred Thompson or, of course, now Governor Romney. The end result of this, I think, is that Senator McCain is the front runner. He has the time now on his side. I think he will do very well in the so-called Potomac primaries in the Washington, D.C. area, Maryland, Virginia next week. And I think it's McCain's now to lose. But Governor Huckabee has thrown a curveball in this race that if you had asked any Republican even a month ago whether Huckabee would be a factor, they would say, no way, but Huckabee is here to stay, and I don't think he's getting out in the foreseeable future, and it hurts Romney.
Now, Mary, there actually has been some kerfuffling, word I made up, over in the conservative camps. Bob Dole wrote a letter to talk show host Rush Limbaugh, criticizing Limbaugh for attacking McCain's conservative credentials. Dole said that Limbaugh should stop for the sake of the Republican Party and signed his letter, God Bless America, Bob Dole. I'm going to talk a little bit more about other stuff, but I know that you have talked about the Democrats and whether or not they've entered circular firing squad mode. What do you think about this?
I'm wondering if Roger Wilkinson and I wrote this letter to Governor Dean, DNC chair, telling him that based on our look at the history of conventions, every time the Democrats have had a credentials fight at the convention, they lost the election. I mean, that's not the only reason why they lost, but that's one of the reasons out there in public with all that fighting and then people going home being mad, because always somebody's going to be mad, whoever loses. And so we suggested that what he might do is show some leadership and solve this problem of that huge number of delegates from Florida and Michigan now rather than waiting. And the longer he waits, the harder it's going to be, because when the race is tight, as it tightens and you get closer. And so, but I don't, I'm not sanguine about it, because when I was at CNN last night, they said Wolf Blitzer tried to get him to respond, and he just kept saying it wasn't his problem. But
now, let me just back up a little bit, a little context. Those states moved up their primaries. They were stripped of their delegates. So that's the context in which you're talking.
Right. And in Michigan, the only person on the ballot was Clinton. The others weren't. And in Florida, they all were. She won. Obama came in second, but they don't have any delegates. And now what the party is saying, which is why Roger and I wrote the note in the interest of disenfranchisement, and just because we're historians and we like to show how smart we are, was that what you guys ought to do is settle this doggone thing and figure out what you're going to do with all those votes. And remember Florida. I mean, we have the hangover of 2000 with all those people claiming disenfranchisement. No party should want to be the party that kept some people. Forget about the officials who decided to have the thing and to try to get in front of the line. What about the people? And it was over a million something who voted, for example, in Florida. It was more than all the people who had voted before. So if they don't settle it, then there will be, I think, a big mess and won't do well for the party at the convention.
Well, considering what Mary just said, Ron, you know, and what Bob Dole said about Rush Limbaugh, how the powerful James Dobson of the group Focus on the Family is just basically said that if McCain wins, he won't even vote. Are the Republicans entering a mode of internal squabbling?
I think we have. I think that there is a lot of concern about Senator McCain becoming the nominee. Mary and I off air were having this discussion that a lot of conservatives look and they question Senator McCain's position on tax cuts. They look at his support of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform legislation, and they say, is this the best that we can do? Now, on the other hand, even a middle-of-the-road John McCain is much better than a Senator Clinton or a Senator Obama for what Republicans view as the proper way to shepherd the economy and preserve for a strong national defense. So at the end of the day, the Rush Limbaughs and the Dobsons who say that, you know, I'm not going to vote for McCain, if it's up against Clinton or if it's up against Obama, they might hold their nose in the polls and vote because Senator McCain would be more closely aligned with their ideological stances than either of the two senators from the Democratic side of the ledger at the end of the day.
Well, let me get one more thing from Ron. So could this be a neutralizer if Huckabee became the vice presidential candidate?
Actually, I mean, I hate to invoke Ronald Reagan's 11th commandment, not to speak ill of another Republican, but I have to be honest with you. If Governor Huckabee is on the ticket, a lot of Republicans will stay home. They'll sit on their hands and they're going to say, there's no way in God's green earth I'm going to vote for McCain and Huckabee. Forget about it. I don't think that would happen.
So who would be your McCain add-on, I guess?
Well, I don't think it would happen, but McCain would be smart to look at somebody like Governor Romney, who at least has interested some of the Republicans out there in the base. If I were John McCain, I would be looking for a conservative governor, someone who has practical executive experience, or someone who has, again, additional credentials on the right that would appease some of the conservatives, but a Governor Huckabee ticket running with McCain, I think, would be fraud and peril and disaster.
Wow. But how do you really feel? Mary, before we let you go, who is a good add-on for Senator Clinton or Senator Obama?
Well, in the on the Democratic side, again, we were talking off air, if Hillary Clinton gets the nomination, there will be great pressure for her to put Obama on the ticket for him to be on. If he gets the nomination, she won't be on the ticket. I don't think he would have her on the ticket, and I don't think she would want to be vice president, although there may be some pressure from the rank and file to try to pull that off. And I think if it's Obama, he would do well to get some staid, solid citizen who hopefully has some kind of military experience and some kind of eminent grease, say a Wes Clark type or somebody, just threw out that name, to try to run on the ticket with him. So if it's Clinton, it probably will be Obama as VP, and if it's Obama, it won't be Clinton as VP.
All right. Well, we're going to keep our crystal balls all polished. Ron, Mary, thank you both.
All right. Thank you, Farai.
Ron Christie is vice president of the lobbying group DC Navigators. He's also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. And Mary Frances Berry is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Both joined us from NPR DC headquarters. Some people say you shouldn't talk religion or politics over dinner. You might get a pie in your face or worse, but if you want to know where the campaign money is flowing, you can be nosy in the privacy of your own home. The info is a mouse click away. Jeffrey Bennett is here to explain. He's our web producer here at News and Notes. Hey.
Hey, Farah.
So what are we talking about?
Well, it's a service that HuffingtonPost.com is offering. It's called Fundraise 2008. All you do is enter a street address, and the site provides the names, addresses, and occupations of the people who live in that area, and the candidates they've backed and how much they've given them. And you can search by a person's name or by a company, for instance, if you want to see how political support breaks down at a place like Halliburton or Google or Bank of America. And it seems like an invasion of privacy, but all this campaign information is public, and it's all on the web. And we have a link to that site on our blog.
Wow. Sounds like you could have a neighbor-to-neighbor fight. You don't even have to put the sign out in front of your yard that says, I support Romney or Hillary or whoever. Somebody can just find out, and then they can drop you a little nasty note.
if they wanted to, yeah.
So last week, we also talked to Congresswoman Maxine Waters about her endorsement of Hillary Clinton. What's been the response online?
Some criticism from Maxine Waters and other members of the Congressional Black Caucus, not just for the endorsement, or I should say not because of the endorsement, but because of this perception among some of our readers that the CBC hasn't been as effective as they should be. One person called them old guard reactionaries who are groveling for crumbs from the table. Another called them seat warmers, saying they have nothing new to offer. And that led to a larger conversation about Obama support among blacks and where black folks stand in the Democratic Party.
And we are in good old Black History Month. Now, of course, we are black 365 days a year. Right. But from what I've read on our blog, not everybody thinks that Black History Month is a good idea.
Yeah, it's this issue that comes up every February, whether or not Black History Month is necessary or relevant. We asked that question to our readers, and the reaction was divided. One person said it's been commercialized and has lost some of its value. A reader named Rawa Naguse said it's critical to designate a certain time to provide history lessons and give credit to the many African-American contributions that go unrecognized.
Now, we kicked off a month-long series on African-Americans in film, whether it's people who are portrayed in films, actors, behind the scenes. I listed a bunch of my favorite movies, ranging from The Shawshank Redemption to Heidi Ho, which is the Cab Calloway feel good, get your nostalgia on. How have people responded to that?
There are lots of cinephiles on our site, apparently. They have said some of your favorites were their favorites as well. Movies like City of God, Glory, Matrix, and some others. And for this series, we're also looking for amateur filmmakers. So if people have created films and they can be viewed online, we want them to send us the link.
All right. Well, Jeff, thanks.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes. He has been right here with me at our studios at NPR West. Now we've got our bloggers roundtable with more politics, also an Ohio case of a police shooting that's causing huge racial tensions. We've got Lauren Williams, editor of the blog Stereohyped, pop culture critic Desmond Burton of the blog Afro Nerd, and Josen Cummings. He writes the blog Broke Thoughts on King Magazine's website. He's also the site's editor. Hey, everybody.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Go Giants.
Yeah, exactly. It's like that's the other thread. It's like the Super Bowl and then the Super Tuesday.
Yeah, buddy.
So was anybody surprised by the results?
I was surprised with Huckabee, actually. I think Huckabee is showing himself. I mean, it looks like McCain is going to be the front runner. He is the front runner. But Huckabee really, if anything, it shows that that the public is they're actually voting for who they really want to vote for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was surprised by Massachusetts. Just because that Obama lost, considering the big time endorsements he got there from Senator Kerry and Kennedy, and so that was kind of a shock to me that he lost that one state.
I found Massachusetts surprising, and I guess Connecticut too. But generally, Barack Obama did really well, and I think that people weren't exactly expecting him to do as well as he did.
Now, Lauren, you've been blogging about women in the campaign. There's big name women who support Barack Obama, including Maria Shriver, Oprah, Caroline Kennedy. You also wrote about how Oprah's getting flack from some female fans for not supporting Hillary. What are people saying?
There is, I think, on her website, on a message board on her website, there were some fans who accused her of being a traitor to women, which is absolutely ridiculous. And she answered that, I think, Sunday in L.A. at the big rally with Maria Shriver and Michelle Obama, and basically said, you know, I'm a free woman. I love Barack Obama because I like him as a candidate, not because he's black and not because I'm a woman.
Now, Josen, there was definitely some a big trend, more and more black people voting for Senator Obama over time. And I think that, you know, one of the things that's come up is, you know, is it about issues? Is it about race? Is it about wanting to back a winner? Because there's signs that show that the more you win, the more people want you to win and the more people want to be on the winning side. So how do you break out that black support for Obama?
I think that the latter is definitely the case, where a lot of people were on the fence in the beginning, and it was about electability, and a lot of black folks just wanted to see a Democrat in office, and they thought Hillary was the best shot. But once the Iowa caucuses got underway, I really started to see, even in talks with my own friends, how that was slowly beginning to change, and they were realizing, hold up now, he can do it. I would say that a lot of people just got the fever, whatever that the Obama fever, and just went ahead and were like, you know what? It's down to these two people. I didn't even think he would get this far. And now that he is this far, I'll put it on my shoulders and I'll go ahead and I'll vote for the brother.
I got so many text messages, emails, blah, 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 telling me to go out and vote. I got a call from my cousin in San Diego asking me to give some, you know, private political analysis of the race. Do you guys feel that people are engaged? It certainly seems that way to me.
Oh, yeah.
It's definitely the talk of the town.
Mm-hmm. Right up there with the Super Bowl. I mean, we're here, we're here in New York, and the New York Giants just won, and yesterday we just had Super Tuesday. We had the Super Bowl parade for the New York Giants, and we have Fashion Week going on.
Yeah.
We got a bunch of things going on in this city, and yeah, I really do think that Super Tuesday and this race dominates the discussion at, you know, tables everywhere.
Well, one thing I thought that was something to note was that you finally saw the liberals actually vying for the black vote.
Right.
I always likened blacks who vote in the liberal side as being somewhat like being affiliated with a spouse that's abusive.
Right.
You know, no matter how abusive your spouse is, you're still going to go back to this person.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, this is going to be a big question mark for whether or not we actually see black folk basically dividing their vote.
Definitely.
So you're saying that it's in play. But, Lauren, what about on the Republican side? I mean, we've talked a lot about whether or not Republicans have gone to African-American-themed debates. Do you see any indication that because of what's going on the Democratic side, Republicans might start playing ball with the black vote?
One would think, but I haven't really seen that much of an indication. I do know that there's a large conservative coalition for Mike Huckabee. I've seen a lot of interesting information about that, but, you know, they didn't go to the black debate, and I still sort of feel like they're not investing a lot of energy.
I think right now they're concerned about their base. I think the party's base is at odds right now. I mean, you know, at that South Carolina debate, it really looked like the Democrats didn't have their stuff together. It looked very fickle, and the Republicans were looking like the party that had their stuff together. But now after Super Tuesday, they still have three people in it. With the Democrats, you only have to worry about the two. And we're still in primary mode. I think when they nail down their candidate, they'll finally go ahead and the Republicans will start pandering to the black vote.
Well, I think with McCain especially, looking at him as a liberal wolf in conservative sheep's clothing. So, so right now, if anything, you see that the public is actually going more to the centrist political paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see if that actually holds water as the race continues.
All right. Well, guys, we're going to have to take a break, but you will stay with us. We've been talking with bloggers Lauren Williams, Desmond Burton, and Josen Cummings. Next on News and Notes, more from the Bloggers Roundtable. Plus, he's young, smart, and unafraid. But Newark's Mayor Cory Booker has upset lots of folks as he's fought to fix the troubled city. I talk with Peter Boyer about his recent New Yorker article on the controversial mayor. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We continue our bloggers' roundtable with Lauren Williams, the editor of the blog Stereohyped, pop culture critic Desmond Burton of the blog Afro Nerd, and Josen Cummings. He writes the blog Broke Thoughts on King Magazine's website and is the site's editor. So, Josen, you are blogging about celebrity endorsements. Specifically, you're writing about this new video, which, again, I've got 10 million emails about, called Yes, We Can, featuring will.i.am and a lot of other celebs. Let's take a listen.
It was a creed written into the founding documents that declared the destiny of a nation. Yes, we can. It was whispered by slaves and abolitionists as they blazed the trail toward freedom. Yes, we can.
So if you've got your invisible goggles on, you can see a bunch of celebrities in black and white and, you know, split screen with Barack Obama. Do you think that this has juiced the campaign a little bit, Josen?
I think it's I don't really think that it's juiced the campaign up any more than it's already been juiced. Barack Obama, since the beginning, has to me been a popular celebrity candidate. And this will.i.am track that just came out only added to that, but not in a way where we're going to see like a boost in popularity. Of all the candidates outside of probably Hillary Clinton, I would say that Barack Obama is actually the biggest celebrity. I mean, he has serious star power, not just political power, star power. And that comes from the fact that he's been affiliated with celebrities since day one, since Oprah, Jay-Z, Beyonce, Chris Rock. They've all participated in this movement in some capacity or another. I think if anything, this just adds a soundtrack to his campaign.
Now, Lauren and Desmond, I want to tick off a few other people. Now, we've talked about Barack supporters, but Hillary Clinton has Barbara Streisand, former porn star Jenna Jameson, Jerry Springer, 50 Cent. Huckabee has pro wrestler Ric Flair, action movie man Chuck Norris, and the heavily armed rocker Ted Nugent. McCain has the Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone, Tom Selleck. Ron Paul has Howard Stern and Arlo Guthrie. I'd like to see them go on tour together. Mitt Romney has Donnie and Marie Osmond, Ann Coulter, and Pat Boone. Now, that's a pretty diverse basket. Would any of those people sway your vote, Lauren?
Well, you know, Arlo Guthrie, I sort of vote, you know, whoever he endorses. That's a joke. No, I don't think any of them would sway my vote. I think that when you look at the celebrities that are endorsing each candidate, you kind of see that, you know, you kind of see in a wider sense the sorts of people that the candidates are grabbing in terms of real voters. And, you know, the young voters love Barack Obama, and I think that's apparent.
And don't forget that
the
Grateful Dead, the surviving members, did come back for Barack as well. So it's not just young people.
Desmond, marijuana smoke cleared.
Yeah. Desmond, is this important? Is this whole celeb?
Not at all. Not at all. I think that the public presently is showing you that they really want to vote for who they really want to vote for. And I think that, if anything, we're looking at living mannequins when it comes to celebrities and celebrification of society. So I don't put any real bearing with these individuals.
I want to take all of us into some much more serious waters. Moving on to this story about 26-year-old Tarika Wilson of Lima, Ohio. She was shot and killed during a drug raid last month. Her 1-year-old son was wounded. Now, the police chief says they'd long been investigating her boyfriend. The boyfriend was arrested later that night, charged with suspicion of possession of crack cocaine, and both marijuana and crack were found in the house. So we spoke with a member of the Lima Police Department. He confirmed these details. The police officer in the shooting has been placed on administrative leave, and the police have released very little other information about whether Tarika Wilson was armed. Lauren, you've been blogging about this. What are people saying?
Shockingly, a lot of my readers sort of, you know, the police brutality aspect of it, the shocking, you know, the shocking fact that a policeman shot this woman and her baby is sort of being glossed over, and people are really getting into a conversation about the choices that the woman made and how her life choices put her in this dangerous situation, and whether or not, you know, not that she had it coming to her, but sort of just that if she hadn't been the girlfriend of this drug dealer, she never would have, you know, been killed by the cops to begin with.
I think that what we're seeing here is some Gina Six fatigue, though. This is definitely a situation that I feel is worth speaking out about and definitely worthy of being upset about. But, you know, the kinds of reactions that Lauren is getting on her blog, I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that after Gina Six, we put so much into that as a community and as a people that now we're just kind of exhausted. And the next thing that we come together for as a people, well, we're going to pick that thing very carefully. And I don't necessarily agree with that mindset, and I can't speak for everybody, but I really do think that whenever we get up in arms about racial injustice, it kind of makes it difficult for us to do it again the next day and the next day after that.
What about that issue of Gina Six fatigue? Josen, do you think that's true? Desmond, do you think that's
okay? definitely. I think we're dealing with, well, first of all, I'm probably going to be a bad guy on this subject matter. Because, listen, I know that there's such a thing as police malfeasance. But I think that, if anything, black folk are going to have to learn how to deal with malfeasance inside and outside of the police force and looking at structural problems. If anything, we're talking about, well, in looking at that story, I saw pit bulls being mentioned, drug dealing, stereotypical underclass Afrocentric names, those kind of things. No one wants to really talk about it. If anything, my blog was spurred because of Dr. Cosby's message, and I feel that we have to speak honestly about what is actually happening with some of our black people, some of the underclass black folk. And if we continue to have this make me feel good politics, referencing Halle Berry and Munster's Ball, if we still have those kind of politics with Team Justice coming in, and those who know me, Team Justice Sharpton and Jackson, we're going to end up with the same kind of story. It's going to be the same thing where we start seeing either candles and stuffed animals and not really getting to the heart of what's happening with our people.
Don't tell me you're blaming Afrocentric names.
Her name's Tarika, has anything to do with it?
It has means a lot. Check out Freakonomics. Freakonomics talks about that. We're not talking about Barack. Barack is an authentic African name. But if we're talking about Lakeisha, Trikeisha, Lokeisha, there's a theme. There's a constant theme that we're seeing with these kind of stories. And I think if we're going to, even referencing Obama, Obama has said, I've been referencing him a lot recently, Obama has even said that we cannot continue to follow in the same political paradigm and expect different results. So I think that we're going to have to really be honest about what's happening with some of these communities, or else we're going to be back to the same circle again, 180 degrees or not 180 degrees, the same circle as this is going to happen again.
Well, you know what? This is such a shame. This is the end of our time, but I can tell we're gonna get letters, so we have to pick this up. And lady, gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Lauren Williams, who edits the blog Stereohyped, Josen Cummings, who writes the blog Broke Thoughts on King Magazine's website. He's also the site's editor. And pop culture critic Desmond Burton of the blog Afro Nerd. All were at NPR's New York studios, and you can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. Barack Obama has been called the face of a new generation of African-American politicians. Reed, highly educated, post-civil rights, and people who appeal to a mixed political constituency. You might add Newark, New Jersey Mayor Cory Booker to that list. But while Obama has taken broad steps across the political universe, the 38-year-old Booker has chosen a different path. His chosen city is one of the most troubled in America. Is Booker's relationship with the residents who elected him also troubled? Journalist Peter Boyer spent about a month shadowing Booker, and he's with us now. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good day to you.
Yes. Well, let's take a look at Newark. Its problems have existed long before Cory Booker became mayor in 2006. Give us an overview of Newark when he became mayor.
Well, Newark was one of the oldest cities in the country and had been one of the most robust on the East Coast, really until just after the Second World War, and pretty much everything started unraveling at once. I mean, the local economy, it had been the most industrialized city in the United States. Several of its key industries left for various reasons. The demography changed. The upheaval of the 1960s came. The riots of 67 happened, and it was downhill on a pretty straight line after that.
Now, like Barack Obama, Booker campaigned on a message of change, but his change was also aimed at, you know, traditional black politics. Tell us about what happened when he ran.
Well, what happened in Newark was after the 67 riots, Newark established itself in a philosophical as well as, you know, a demographic way as a black city, which is to say there were elements of black nationalism involved in the election in 1970 of Newark's first black mayor, Kenneth Gibson, who ran City Hall for 2 decades, and he was followed by Sharp James, Newark's second black mayor. And so you had for 40 years these two black mayors of a decidedly a demographically black city presiding in much the same corrupt way as their Irish and Italian predecessors had. And what Cory Booker came in and basically said was, corruption is corruption. It has no color. Inefficiency is inefficiency. It has no color. And to confuse the blackness of Newark with the way things always have been is a mistake, and I'm not going to do it. He was, of course, opposed by folks like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, and who I think subsequently were discredited because of their opposition.
Now, this whole issue of black authenticity, it's come up a lot in this presidential election. How has Booker handled the charge that he's not black enough?
Well, he has pretty much laughed it off. I mean, there have been a couple of times early on when Jackson called him a wolf in sheep's clothing and so on, when he said it's just, he would make comments like it's ridiculous to wrap yourselves in kente cloth while arguing for the same failed ways and the same failed policies, sort of along the lines of what one of your previous guests was talking about. But he has pretty much ignored it, and he says there's nothing black about good, there's nothing white about good governance, there's nothing black about corruption and insider dealing and inefficiency, and has tried pretty much so far in his first 18 months to govern that way.
Now, what about crime? I mean, Newark, Cory Booker was on television talking about a horrific shooting of some young people not that many months ago. And how is he dealing with the crime issue?
Well, he dealt with it first and foremost in a way that flew in the face of the accusations that that he wasn't black enough, and the way he could prove that he was black enough was, to some people, was to go appoint a black police director. What he did instead was hold a, he is, you know, at heart a technocrat, and he did what technocrats do. He recognized that crime was probably, and still is, Newark's foremost problem. Everything derives from that. He conducted a nationwide search for the best possible police director. All signs pointed to the success of the New York Police Department during the Giuliani years. So he went east 10 miles and picked probably the top cop in the NYPD, who happened to be a white Irishman from the Bronx. And it caused all manner of upset in Newark, but the two of them pressed forward, and they are beginning to show some positive results.
At the same time, though, the model of, or at least some of the approaches of New York policing included some very controversial fatalities, you know, Amadou Diallo and Patrick Dorisman.
Sure.
Do you think there were echoes of that in the outrage by some black citizens over this choice?
Yes, of course there were. Those, as it happens, the particular cop that Booker chose, Gary McCarthy, happened to have a pretty good record on those very issues you just named. In fact, he moved into the precinct in which the Diallo incident had occurred, and pretty effectively calmed the waters there. As a matter of fact, some of the Newark City Council came to New York and also spoke with African American politicians up in Albany about this guy's record and vetted him pretty thoroughly.
Now, let me, we don't have too much time left, so I just want to ask you this. Is this a situation, you've obviously chosen to profile Mayor Booker, is this a situation where he has a political future outside of Newark? Do you see him moving in a direction where he will eventually run for some other office?
I think he absolutely means to, and I think he is one of all politicians brim with ambition, and he is no exception. I think he has chosen for himself a nearly impossible task, and if he manages to pull it off, it's a pretty solid credential.
All right. Peter Boyer, thanks so much.
Certainly.
That was journalist Peter Boyer. He profiled Newark Mayor Cory Booker in the New Yorker magazine's February 4th edition. We spoke with Mayor Booker's office today, and he's declined an interview, saying he was preparing for the State of the City address tomorrow, but his office has kept the door open for a future conversation.